Thank you for the messages some of you all sent, whether in the group chat or private message. Thanks for the concern. It was quite interesting, yeah, because shortly after the blast, WhatsApp and Facebook got cut off. Yeah. So for a while, it was like some messages still went through. Then gradually it just stop. Yeah. And then I thought, just nice. I was starting my personal retreat, so they were supporting my retreat. But it is a tragedy. Yeah. Many lives were lost. When I left, it was about 290 over. Initially, it went up to 300 plus, but it was a miscount. It's that bad, yeah, because there were body parts and which led to some confusion as to how many individuals were actually killed in the blast. Yeah. I hesitated to write anything about it even after coming back, but I still dropped a short line. I'm not sure whether it's insensitive to those who perish, yeah, but I think it's important, especially at such time, to know that even the perpetrators, yeah, those who walk around with the bomb and kill a few hundred individuals, they need love and compassion as well. Yeah. I mean, ask yourself. Sometimes in our life, things are going so wrong. You feel like, you know, strangling your boss, you know. Yeah, but most of us, we don't end up doing that. Most of us, when we look at news such as this, we are left puzzled. And it's easy for the narrative to then pin them as evil people who are trying to destroy the world and so on. Maybe some of them really are. I don't know. I mean, I don't know them, you see. I didn't go to primary school with them. Yeah. But imagine if you did go to primary school with one of them or some of them. Chances are they are like, just like you and me, you know. And in our time, you know, we play goalie, we climb monkey swing. Chances are they are just like that. But along the way, at some point, something must have happened, yeah, that caused them to feel that a sense of where they're so troubled, yeah, then it feels like that's the only thing they can do. I'm not suggesting it's right to do that. But I sometimes ask some students, you know, when you see the shooting in US, don't go on a moral high horse and start thinking that, oh, you see, they are like this, like that. Because when I first visited US in 2000, I was surprised when I walked into Walmart. I was working at that point in time. I walked into Walmart and I saw AR-15 on the wall. I saw guns just hanging on the wall. And I was so curious, I went up to a counter and I was like, are these real? And then the counter staff looked at me like, yeah, they are real. And because in Singapore, something like a gun is, the only time you get to hold it is in NS, you know? Yeah, or in movies. Even the BB shooter, the gun pellet type toy, you have to import in, you know, it's illegal, you know, you have to go through some special arrangement. Yeah, it's just so different. So I ask students, if for some reason we have access to guns, do you think it will not happen in Singapore? I assure you it will. It can and it will. Yeah. When people are troubled enough, All it takes is someone to give a suggestion, push you a bit, push you off. Boom, it happened. Yeah. So someone who is at peace, someone who don't feel oppressed, someone who don't have any problem in their life, wouldn't wake up one day and say, hey, you know what, let me make some C4. Let me go and buy some fertilizer and some, different compounds and mix them together. Yeah, and then let's look for a crowded place. I mean, who does that? But we have to be careful not to then demonize, you know, the whole group as well. Yeah. And that's why in the chat group and the Facebook post I highlighted that, you know, we should extend love and compassion to them also. Because only when they have that, then there will be real peace. Yeah. More guns and security checks, temporary measure. And I appreciate, it's not that I don't appreciate the ground crews, not just in Sri Lanka, but all over the world. So every time when I go through checkpoint, I try to make it a point, if I'm not late, to look the person in the eye and thank them. And I'll tell you, a few times when I thank them, then they look at me, and you see a sense of relief from them. Before that, they look so tense, you know, when they're checking you. Then I look at them, thank you for doing this. And there was once one guy actually said, well, thank you. Thank you for understanding. It's not that we want to do this. Yeah, it's their job. Yeah. So when we recite the five precepts, don't underestimate that. Because if you think about it, even for just one day, if for just one day, the whole world round were to say, hey, you know what? Never mind our time zone difference, never mind our cultural, linguistic, religious differences, let's all commit to just one day. Not suggesting that the next day we start killing each other, but just for the one day we make absolute sure that none of us carry out any acts of harmfulness. To observe this basic principle of harmlessness. Not to call it five precepts, because if you call it five precepts, then it becomes a Buddhist thing. Yeah, not that I'm against, I mean, I'm wearing this, what am I against? Right? But it's that if you call it five precepts, then others may say, hey, then I want to call it you call it whatever you want to call. You know? But if imagine, just for one day, if on Sunday everybody had observed this, none of this would be happening, you know. None of this would be happening. And if you look at all the moments in history, in time, throughout human history, on that particular day when there is a start of this major conflict, if on that day, somehow, one day before that, everybody decided, okay, tomorrow we shall not kill. Eh? No World War I. Eh? No World War II. Yeah. Human history would have been so different. You would not be marked with massacre, killings, and mindless violence. Yeah. So don't look at the five precepts, yeah, as a very mild, basic practice. It's a very fundamental practice that I think if there's anything, you know, before I came back, there was one afternoon, I think it was actually on the last day, Bhante Vimalajyoti. He's in Sri Lanka for his PhD, final dissertation defense. And because of the bombing, it got extended because all the schools are closed. And so we met up, and then he was sharing something about how in some of the countries, in fact in Sri Lanka, when the ministers or the queen or the, you know, different persons of the state arrive, everybody would stand, but the Sangha remained sitting. I first observed this when I was in Thailand and in Cambodia. Even when the king arrived, they remained sitting. Yeah. Some look at it as a sign of pride, you know, hao lian. Yeah, very proud. Oh, Sangha so proud. But there's actually some background to this, and it's about the notion that the Sangha, as I mentioned earlier, it should practice to be worthy of hospitality, worthy of respect, and so on. And then, contrary to this, then we say, who else is worthy? Not so much someone who wears this, but he who practices to remove evil. Yeah. And so we rise towards those, yeah, who are like that. We don't rise simply because the person is older. We don't rise simply because the person is of authority or power. Mm. On one hand, it's like against the social norms. Everybody stand, then the Sangha doesn't stand. But if you, in a certain angle, if you think about it, if your spiritual teacher can be made to rise simply because someone has power, then the person can also be made to do other things or say other things when pressured by people of power. Or do you want your spiritual teacher to stick to the truth? Yeah, so there's that element. But the angle that Bhante Vimalajyoti was highlighting was, even then, it's a bit odd, lah. You know, especially when it was interfaith circle, you know, when different religious leaders come, then they will stand up and greet each other, but the Sangha just sit like that. Hello? Yes. Then, but of course in Singapore, we don't do that. In Singapore, whoever come will stand, and you know, sometimes they even shake our hands. Then a thought came to me. I told Bhante, I said, I was just thinking, if standing can bring peace, why not? You know, why not? Yeah. If all the people in the world who want to do harm in the world were to say, monk, you, Venerable Chuanguan, in particular, Venerable Chuanguan, you come and prostrate to me, then I don't kill people. Tell me when. When and where. Just tell me. I will go and prostrate to you. Doesn't matter. I mean, to me, you think about it, hey, it's worthwhile, you know. If you want me to prostrate to you every day, that day I don't prostrate, you kill people, I will go, I'll make sure I prostrate to you every day. Yeah. I mean, I was... Yeah, if you ask me, so what if I'm Shifu? If doing that can bring peace to the world, let's do it, you know? Yeah. But unfortunately, nobody ever suggested that. So I cannot bring peace to the world by prostrating to people. But what the Buddha observe is that when you do certain practices, it can bring peace to yourself. It can bring peace to yourself. It can bring you liberation. Not all practices, unfortunately. In a way, if you look at the sutta, you find that the Buddha is not very politically correct. He don't go around saying, your practice was so good, that one was so good, everything good. No. He sometimes even specifically say that certain practices are fruitless. He don't make it his agenda, he don't make it his personal goal to go around disparaging people. But then in the Buddha's time, different individuals would come to see him and try to defeat him in his teaching. He was not someone, the Buddha was not someone to shy away from confrontation, so to speak. Yeah? When people come to talk to him, he'll talk to them. Unless he observed that, no point talking, then he remains silent. Yeah? Or sometimes he knows that at this stage of the person's spiritual maturity, no matter whether I answer this way or that way, you cause the person even more doubts and confusion. Then the Buddha keep quiet. But in many cases, individuals come to ask the Buddha question, and in the process of that dialogue, then the Buddha in return also asks them about their practice. Sometimes the Buddha don't tell them about the Buddha's teaching. In a few suttas I observe, when individuals come and ask the Buddha, Master Gotama, tell us what is your practice. And you know what the Buddha said? No. Let's not talk about the Buddha's Dhamma Vinaya. Let's talk about yours. Sometimes the Buddha do that. And in a few of this, the Buddha will ask them what their practice is. The Buddha don't make assumptions and jump to conclusions. The Buddha asks them, what do you practice? And then ask them, when you practice in this way, what is it supposed to bring? What is the result, intended result? Yeah. There's the practice itself, and then there's the intended result. And there must be a way to verify that result. Not just a should have lah. And so in this way, for some of the practices, then the Buddha, through the back and forth dialogue, it turned out that those practices were futile, fruitless. So when we, in today's topic, precepts, attachment to rites and rituals. This attachment to rites and rituals is one of the fetter, that is overcome by the sotapanna, stream enterer. The Chinese translation is 戒禁取. Do you need me to write it down? Sometimes I find it's helpful, sometimes I don't find it helpful. Yeah, because covering the Buddha, then there's a big screen, then you all keep looking at the screen, no eye contact. Then after a while, you start to think about other things. 戒禁取. Can you understand? 戒, precepts. Then 禁, 禁止的禁. 取. So it's actually 戒禁取. Yeah, that means 取 is grasping, attachment, in other words. Attachment to what? To those practices of abstinence. 戒禁. Yeah, so certain practices say this cannot do, that cannot do, must do like this, must do like that. Yeah. So grasping onto this. But does it mean that we shouldn't grasp onto precepts? In other words, we shouldn't observe precepts? No. Over the years, when I say over the years, I have to give some context. It means, in this case, it means since I was young. Yeah. Not after I become a monk, since I was young. I've heard people mention about this. Yeah, 戒禁取. But over the years, I realized that different people use it differently. And it, may I say so, wrongly sometimes. Yeah, sometimes the word 戒禁取 is used in this context. For example, let's say you go to a wedding dinner. And then everybody yum sing. Then you say, oh, I don't take alcohol. Yeah, then another Buddhist say, aiya, 不要这么执着啊, don't be so attached to the precepts. 戒禁取戒. That's the wrong usage. Sometimes it's more meaningful to talk about the wrong usage than the correct usage. Because correct usage is very straightforward. But it's the wrong usage that we have to be careful. Attachment to this particular factor, you must know when it says attachment to rites and rituals, some translation, it's not just talking about, oh, if you do ritual, then it's wrong. Even if you do something that seems to be a religious practice, yeah, but you do it with the wrong view, or you do a practice without knowing how it's supposed to work, but you just do it because you think that just doing it will bring some results, that falls under this category. Adherence to the precepts is not under this. So if you are strict with your precepts, it's not 戒禁止啊. It is sticking to practices and precepts that doesn't bring you forward spiritually, doesn't bring progress on the path. This is the category. This is the category. So, in the Buddha's time, there are some practices that were seen among the ascetics. In many of the commentary, it's highlighted two particular ones. 持狗戒, 持牛戒. So in the sutta, it's known as the 牛狗外道. Yeah. Now, for most of us in modern times, like, what? Yeah. So in the Buddha's time, and I think even until today, there are some of these ascetics lineages that are still alive, you know. So these two particular ones, one, they would live like a dog. It's not an insult, this is what they advocate. You ask them, they will very proudly tell you, yes, from seven generations ahead, yeah, before me, this is how my, you know, the master, seven generations before, or even up to 1,000, 2,000 years ago, this is what we have been practicing. So they will live their life like a dog, on fours, and they pee like this, and so on. Then the 持牛戒, to practice like a cow. They will eat, finish their meal, then after a while, regurgitate. Yeah, in Singapore, when we use the word regurgitate, it usually means verbally regurgitate. But in that particular ascetic practice, they literally induce to come out and then chew again and then swallow. So live like a cow. But do not be mistaken that this is an insult. Nor should you be mistaken to think of it as a praise. But it's just as a matter of fact that, you see, these practitioners in the Buddha's time, it is not that they are crazy. They are not crazy, you know. It's that according to the Buddha, yeah, there's a sutta on it, their teachers who started this line of practice actually are meditators. They manage to practice until they have psychic vision. So they were able to see the rebirth of a cow, rebirth of a dog. And they saw the cow after dying being reborn in heaven, in the heavenly state. And then wrongly draw the conclusion that the life of a cow is wholesome, that the life of a dog is wholesome. You know, in modern times, we have the phrase, all dogs go to heaven. I don't know how related they are. So the Buddha highlighted, yes, the teacher did see this, but it's a wrong inference. The karmic ripening of human, of the heavenly rebirth, is not directly due to the life as lived by a dog, but by past karma that this teacher only has the ability to see the later part, not the front part. So, missing information. And so as a result, the Buddha declared that is a fruitless practice. The actual practice that lead to heavenly rebirth is twofold. Practice of giving and practice of the precepts. Yeah. So, you may want to think of Buddhist practices. Ask yourself, what are the Buddhist, common Buddhist practices, or common practices in Singapore, Buddhist or otherwise? Which of them are actually fruitless? When we say fruitless, we have to also fruitless in a sense of removing greed, hatred, and delusion. That's a higher goal. Okay? Then the secondary goal is fruitless in developing concentration. And then even lower, fruitless in having any merit at all. Yeah. So for example, you donate to charity, you cannot say it's fruitless, but it does produce some fruit. But at least it produces worldly fruit. Yeah, charity. So don't dismiss everything else all at once. But there are certain practices that may not produce any of these three categories. Yeah. So first category is like giving, you know, kindness and so on. Second category would be samadhi. Then third category would be insight. How about just now when we talk about offering of light, offering of flowers, offering of incense? And that's why when we do these practices, the introspection, yeah, the Buddhist reflection must come in. Otherwise it becomes just a ritual. Yeah. It becomes just a ritual. In fact, this morning when I was doing light offering, then I was doing prostration, I was reflecting also, yeah, when we do prostration. Sometimes when we do it every day, then it becomes just a go through motion, you know. You must know that in the Buddha's time, you are literally paying respect to the Buddha. Can you imagine? Can you imagine that? Can you picture that? The Buddha himself. So my teacher, he advised us when you are doing puja and you are doing the prostration, don't look at the statue and think you are bowing to the statue. But use the statue or the painting or the carving as an inspiration to remind you of the Buddha and visualize as though the Buddha is right in front of you. With that kind of mindset, wow. Then you bow. Then it is very different. So, precepts. Good to observe. Yeah. When I say good to observe, that's mean not the kind of optional. Yeah. It's actually not so much optional or not optional. Yeah. Our mindset towards precepts are very important. We may not be able to uphold all of them 100%. Yeah, because you know our own mindset, our own defilements, our own habit, you know, lifestyle, and so on and so forth, work, whatever. But at least our attitude towards precepts should be purified, even if our observance itself is maybe not 100%. Of course, ideally, don't be mistaken me, and then go around telling people, oh, Sifu, Venerable Chankun, very good. He very kind one. He said, just have the right attitude. Observance don't have to be 100%. I didn't say that. For the records, I didn't say that. Yeah. We should strive gradually towards purity in our body and speech. And then with that as a basis, purify our mind. And with the body, speech and mind purified, purify our views. And in this way, lead to final liberation. I want to take the opportunity to share something else. Before I come back, I was thinking, when should I share this? And then I look at the topic. I don't want to change the topic. So I thought maybe I should hijack the session. Then later I thought, maybe I can still wait for next week. Then I thought, maybe I die already. So I thought maybe I should share it now. During the retreat, there was one night I asked the participants, I asked them, are you all desperate? Yeah. So I asked you all as well, are you all desperate? If people ask you whether you are desperate, in Singapore it's like an insult. It's like, what do you mean? Huh, Sifu, what? Yeah. Desperate for what? Yes, that's the important thing. What are we desperate for? In our life, there are many things we are desperate for. And when we are desperate, we are willing to go through hardship, we are willing to go through a lot of difficulties, pain even, effort, time, if we are desperate enough. That's the only reason why people queue overnight, you know. Not all of them are desperate for the iPhone. They are desperate for the money from selling the iPhone. You know, some of them are really desperate for the iPhone. Yeah, some of them are desperate for the good feeling they get when they show off the iPhone. But definitely desperate for something. Otherwise, nothing better to do. Don't sleep at night. Go and queue up, and the best thing is, you know, when you are there, you cannot hide. Or then when reporters come, they pan the video, then you, what I'm going to do, wear a plastic bag. And some of them, even very proud, they woke up and then they do interview. Oh, I'm very excited, looking forward to this. Yeah? And when they buy if the person who get to buy the first iPhone, oh, look at their face, huh? Huh? Yeah, to be like that, no? In engineering, we call that the first mover or something. Basically, when the product is first released, it is overpriced. I mean, as a consumer, you all know, but from engineering standpoint, we know it very clearly. And usually the first version, there are some problems with it. But yet they are willing to pay for that premium to get to say, you know. So they are desperate. But I don't say that it's wrong or right. Yeah. But it is that human beings have this capacity for desperation. That desperation can give us energy, can give us courage. You ask people to just go and queue up at night, nothing, and don't get anything, will they do it? They won't do it. Yeah, people queue up for all kinds of things. When parents are desperate enough, they go and do volunteer work. You know? Last time, I mean, I don't say this as a whatever. But when parents are desperate enough, they may even come and look for Shifu last time to recommend for some primary school. No, but because this is on record, I'm not saying that I like look down on them or what, but I see this as something that can be, that can go this way or that way. Because if you think about it, in the case of the parents, it is this desperation for something good for their children. You know? The point is that desperation is a very powerful mental state, you know. It can drive us to do things that normally you wouldn't do. Some would even say crazy things. The question is, what is driving our desperation? When a young person is desperate to prove himself or herself at work, they are willing to, you know, burn the night working OT, weekend burn, you know, neglect the family, yeah, Mother's Day, Father's Day, whatever Valentine's Day skip. They are willing to sacrifice everything, even their health. The question is the thing that is driving our desperation worthwhile? Yeah, so what is driving our desperation in life? I say desperation is not the problem. It's for what are we desperate for? So during the retreat, this came to me. It occurred to me. Am I desperate enough for jhana? Am I desperate enough for enlightenment? So I told the participants, are you desperate enough? Are you desperate enough to lose a leg? Yeah, and when I was sitting, after that I was thinking, yeah, I must be really desperate. Because I realized that, yeah, I want it so badly, I'm willing to lose a leg, you know. Yeah, and I thought to myself, yeah, you see, my mom immediately got a response. And I thought to myself, yeah, if I have to lose a leg, but I can get jhana or enlightenment even better, yeah, I don't mind, you know. Really. She's shaking her leg, her head, not leg, her head. At least I was thinking to myself, at least I can face my mother and say, Mom, I become a cripple, but I'm enlightened. Yeah, if you ask me, if I have to choose. Yeah, she's very worried. So then later really happened. Hey, I tell you, this is something that I want you to occasionally think about. Because until you are so desperate, your effort to meditate, your effort to strive towards Nibbana will be half-hearted. Then it made sense, this story that I heard long time ago about Milarepa and Mahapa. How Milarepa was asked to go and build a house every day. Build a house, then and at the end of the day, the teacher came over, look at it, one leg kick, pram, not good enough. The next day, do again. Don't know how many times, no? But he kept on building. When I first heard, I was like, well, that was stupid. Oh. Milarepa stupid. The teacher unreasonable. What is this, man? I don't think he even do the inspection. He just took one look and just destroyed the house. In the end, worse still, he asked Milarepa to jump off the cliff. And one senior monk told me this story again, and like I heard before. And then he still tell me the story, and he said, Tsuxing, the problem with you is you have too much doubt. You see, Milarepa, no doubt. That's why he can have attainment. You know what I in an instant I told that senior monk, I said, for every one Milarepa, there are a few thousand who fall to their death. For nothing. That's how I felt. But this now, I feel that I can appreciate a different angle. I realize that for me, I don't know whether that is correct, but for me, this account is not simply about blind faith. It's that Milarepa was desperate enough for enlightenment. He was willing to die for it. Then when I think about the Bodhisattva path, the Bodhisattva vows, there are so many teachings about how you must be ready to sacrifice your life for Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. Then I realize it's not about the sacrifice, no. It's about how much you value this. And you realize that in our life, we are capable of doing that. Don't think that you are not Military Park. You are Military Park. It's just that you are chasing after a different thing. Our bosses is like Mama Park. Your bosses tell you, do this, finish it by tomorrow. You really go and finish. Tomorrow, another project come. As you finish, you also finish. Why? Because your boss, or you think your boss can give you something that you really want. You're desperate enough for that. I don't say that that's wrong. Everybody have to choose your own marpa to go after. But until you choose the right one, you will not be enlightened. You will just go after what I see as this. All the worldly things is like trinkets of con men giving it to you. You know trinkets? I'm not saying that your boss con you, don't give you bonus. Your boss really give you bonus, really give you title. Maybe even make you partner. Make you CEO, you are the boss, you become president of the world. Yeah, you become major stakeholder. 49%, he have 51%. I don't say that that is wrong. No, that is not true. It's true. And maybe you become so rich, like that Amazon boss. When he divorced his wife become the third richest woman in the US. I don't say that she didn't become so rich. Yes, all that is true. But I'm telling you, if you see clearly, that is just a trinket of a con man. And the con man is not the people, your boss, you know. You are the con man. Compared to Nibbana, all that is just trinkets. You know what is trinkets? Looks very nice, but not real gem. Not real gem. And until you see this clearly, your efforts will be pursuing things that is insubstantial. You'll be jumping off the cliff, no end. You'll be building one house after another house, but not getting anything out of it. Yeah. Amida. Quite sad, huh? I'm not laughing at you all. I'm laughing at the at this very fact. Yeah, this is how it is, you know. Whether you feel good or bad about it, this is how it is. Yeah. Whether you agree or not, this is how it is. But I don't say that you all must give up your trinkets. Trinkets are very pretty, you know, shiny. Yeah. And it serves its purpose also. But until you see in comparison to Nibbana, that these are trinkets. See, he's desperate for something else. When you see it clearly, then you can understand why people do different things, you know. But I don't say I understand everything. There are a lot of things I also don't understand. Yeah. See? Okay. Anybody have anything to ask or share? That's all I have for you. There were scarier things I told the participants during the retreat. Yeah, during one of the sitting, I told them, actually I told you all a bit of that just now. I told them halfway through the sitting, I said, don't think that you can live for so long. Suddenly there's an earthquake and all of us die here. Don't think you have a few more years, many more years, then you can, when you're free, then you meditate. Don't think that, oh, when like this, like that, then you have time to practice, to learn Dharma. Then after the sitting, I told them, I said, actually, I wanted to tell you something else. But I think it was too much. But I told them after the sitting, I said, maybe halfway through the sitting, you suddenly die and instantly reborn at right there as a hungry ghost. And then you see everybody sitting, but you are not able to sit anymore. You don't think that's going to happen. That may happen. After they left, 20th, 21st, the bomb happened. Maybe we shouldn't talk about those who perish. But imagine if it happened in the Buddhist center. Maybe some of them were still sitting down there listening to so long. You know? Then the ring boom, then. Okay, now you don't have to listen anymore. Now you are reborn somewhere else. And don't think that you are reborn as a human being, you know. So any time when the sitting takes a long time, don't think that it's a long time. Yeah, be thankful that there's still time. If you go on and on, don't finish. Don't let even a thought of, you know, the kind of impatience like arise in your mind. Yeah. Who knows, next moment, Sifu... Yeah. And I told them, I said, I don't say this to frighten people. But after I had that thought, I asked myself, hey, that's quite frightening. I don't know how many people can accept it, you know. But that's, as I told them, that's really how I feel. And I hope that I will continue to feel this way until the end of my life. Yen Xiao San Zhang Zhu Fan Nao. Yen Xiao San Zhang Zhu Fan Nao. Pu Yen Zhu Zhang Si Xiao Chu. Shi Shi Chang Sing Pusada. Amitabha.